Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and filmmaker, and today I'm talking to Bruce Rubin, who is the Oscar-winning scriptwriter of Ghost, Jacob's Ladder, Brainstorm, My Life, and writer now of It's Only a Movie, a memoir, as well as a book of his unmade screenplays called Three Visionary Screenplays. It was an absolute delight to talk to him. As you will hear from the conversation, it was a wide-ranging conversation. We touched on lots of bases. We went in lots of different directions. We went pretty deep, I think. It's unlike any conversation I think we've had on the podcast before, and we're almost at 150 conversations so far on Writers on Film. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, review, do everything you can to share and to spread that liking with the universe. Before that, please enjoy the conversation.
You know, it's just come out. It's a very new experience for me. I've never written a book before. I've written screenplays, and they have a very particular way of getting disseminated into the world. And I'm used to that. I'm not used to a book being on Amazon, and I'm not used to people calling me to say that or telling me they've read my book. It's just like, I mean, it makes sense in a way. It's out there, but it's still odd for me to have it so invisible. It's just a very strange experience.
What are the differences? I mean, from the get-go, I would sort of imagine that there's far less of a filter. You're not going through other people. You're not relying on studios and things. You're just saying what you want to say, basically. Is that true?
In terms of writing, yes. I mean, there's always a critical faculty, whether it's a screenplay or whether it's a memoir or biography, however you want to look at it. You know, you look at your own life through so many lenses, and you look at stories through so many lenses. And when I write a movie, you know, there's a larger sort of governing directive that kind of tells me this is working, this isn't working, this is the story that I think needs to be told. I get often surprised by it and delighted by it, moved by it. Writing your own story, there's a lot of elements. Yeah, and one of those elements is your own memory of narrative of your story and the people who are in it and how they are included in the story, which is very significant. And then, you know, I have a strange life. I have a life that's very much directed by, or seemingly to the audience involved about Hollywood, about movies, about Oscars, about all that kind of stuff, which is a very particular audience that wants to know what's Patrick Swayze really like. And then there's an audience of my family for whom I'm writing a memoir. And how do they fit? And who do you leave out of your memoir? You know, I had a very strange experience directing a film called My Life, which I wrote. And Michael Keaton and Nicole Kidman were in it. And there was a party in which all of my family was in it. And the editor was telling me, well, we have to cut this out. I said, you can't cut that out. That's my cousin Wendy. You can't leave Wendy out of the picture. And that became a real issue. And I found that same thing happened in writing the memoir. How do I cut out part of my family? Where do you draw the line? You know, how many cousins get in, how many aunts and uncles, that kind of thing. And in the beginning, I didn't include any of them, really. I just had a student friend of mine who wanted to do the story of my kind of spiritual life and my filmmaking and how they dovetailed together. And so we did recordings and he put together a book, which it was actually kind of fascinating. And I read it, but I said, you know, it doesn't have an ending, which for me meant that I didn't have what I would call an ultimate spiritual awakening. You know, I didn't have something to give a final moment to the book that everybody said, wow, that's fun, like a Hollywood ending, you know. So I kind of put it aside. And then another friend, a friend of my son's really, and a friend of mine, who's a book editor and has written a number of books on Hollywood people, said he would like to read it. And he did. And he came back to me and he said, where's your father in all this? And I went, well, in the first version of the movie, my dad and my mom and my brothers and sister and brother, they're all gone. And he implied, and I felt it strongly, that they all needed to be there. So I went back and did another version of the movie in which I became very inclusive. And then in the process of becoming inclusive, I kind of realized, who's going to want to read this? You know, I mean, now I have my cousins who will buy it, but I don't know about the mass audience, you know. And that became a kind of an interesting problem for me. Where was the balance? But on the other hand, putting my dad and my mom and everyone else in the book started to make it much more personal. And I decided, if I'm going to do this book, go for everything. Make it personal and forget the audience. Don't worry about who or who will not buy it for whatever reason. Make it the story of your life and let the audience be your two grandchildren, Talia and Eli. That's who this book really ultimately should be for. And it's an interesting story. For me, there's no question it's an interesting story. Even the early stuff with my family has really incredible interest for me. And so I wrote the entire thing. And then exactly what I predicted would happen, we started sending it out to New York publishers. And they said, well, who's the audience for this? And, you know, I could have gone to spiritual publishing houses because much of the story has a kind of an extraordinary spiritual journey behind it, you know, around the world journey and 3 billion year LSD journey, lots of things that were really, you know, sort of part of the formation of who I was. And then very much the formation of the stories I told, you know, and that I was allowed to tell, the movies like Jacob's Ladder and Ghost. And I mean, everything I did ultimately had a kind of a spiritual undercurrent, and that all came from the whole journey. So whether the New York publishers understood what to do with it or not, I started to say, I don't care, which is really true. I've just written it. And it's out there now for the first time. And I am staring at the Amazon screen, seeing the book, you know, the first one. There are two of them, actually, because the editors decided to publish two. One was the memoir itself, which is called It's Only a Movie, which is a line my mother used to use for me when I was a little child. I used to go to the movies with her and get so terrified by everything in the second act that I wanted to hide under the seats. And she'd go, honey, it's only a movie. And then the realization in the kind of spiritual journey that life isn't much different, that it's in a way only a movie. So the title has that double entendre, which is really kind of what I wanted the book to be. And so that got published. And then this other book called Three Visionary Screenplays, not my title. And I don't know how visionary they are, but they are interesting in that they were never made, but they presaged the earlier work that I got made in Hollywood. They were the there were the format and the, and they're very good screenplays, I think, but they were never completely producible. So those got published at the same time. So now I'm a published author, and I have never been that in my entire life, and I don't know how to handle it. So that's my introduction to me.
I love the idea that I remember reading Raymond Chandler once on writers' biographies, and he said something along the lines of, who cares when the writer got his first bicycle? And it's a good line. And I remember thinking, yes, I think I read it in a Raymond Chandler biography, ironically enough. but as I get older, I find increasingly I am interested in when the writer gets their first bicycle. I am interested in those formative experiences. So I thought the first few chapters, when you're talking about your school life, you're talking about your family in great, no, I was going to say in great detail. I don't mean in excessive detail by any stretch. I mean, the pace of the book is very quick moving. I found all that stuff absolutely riveting.
Well, you know, I did not do the first bicycle ride. All it would have had is, you know, riding and falling and riding and falling and finally figuring out how to balance, which I think is everybody's first bicycle ride. And it's a good idea. But I focused more on things like the time my dad got out of the car because he wanted to see a crowd of people standing on what they were looking at, standing on the side of the road. And I was 5 years old, and he took me out with him to see what they were looking at. And they were looking at a girl who had just been in a car accident, lying on the road, dying, blood seeping out through her body into the wool blanket they put on top of her, to which to the day I can't wear wool. I can't wear it in wet environment. But that moment was like, you know, it was not a bicycle ride. It shaped who I was. It was essential. And I wanted to include that in the book. And, you know, there's so many elements from a childhood that speak, you know, loudly. I mean, I remember, like, I describe a moment in my childhood that I actually put in the first film I directed called My Life, and it was me we're going to bed at night, wishing upon a star because I believed in the truth of that idea that something I would wish for would come true, and I wished for there to be a circus in my backyard, and I woke up in the morning and there was no circus in my backyard, and so I figured out in my brain as a kid, well, you didn't give it time to get set up. So what you should do is wish for it to be there after school. So I said, starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight. And I wished for the circus to be there when I got home from school, went to school, and told the entire class that there would be a circus in my backyard that afternoon. There was a substitute teacher. I don't know why, but she had me write my address on the board and everybody copied it down. And then I ran home so excitedly after school to see the circus. And, you know, of course, there was no circus, but all of these people from school with their parents arrived at the house, and my mother completely flummoxed by what are all these people doing here? And they all had all come to see the circus that my brain produced and didn't actually arrive. That's a childhood memory that has, I think, some insight into character. It had a wonderful playoff in the movie of My Life, but, you know, Michael Keaton having a circus in his backyard and actually having a manifest, which is kind of fulfillment for me. So it all dovetails in a certain way. And I really had this remarkable sense that childhood moments, if you pick the right ones, are absolutely predictive of the entire life that follows. And I feel very, I was very lucky to go back and explore my childhood. You know, I found it to be really, really interesting. I mean, that moment of sitting in a sandbox and discovering my whole top of my head disappeared. And I was going, I couldn't understand why would that happen? And what was replacing it was the entire universe itself. And there were things spinning in the sky. And I thought now as an adult of Ezekiel with the wheels spinning in the sky, but it was like galaxies. And I had this feeling that I contained the entire universe. And then whoop, came back. And I was now, I was a kid in a sandbox, but it was very formative, and it remains that. So anyway, telling the beginning of a life is not without its value and purpose. If you see why it had purpose and value and how it laces through the whole of your story and ties it all together.
There are two strands of your early life which are very strong in the book. One is your sexuality as a man who finds out very well, who knows he's gay quite early on, but decides to remain closeted for a long time. And the other is exactly what you were expressing there, that sense of a much broader sense of spirituality than most people maybe have access to or feel comfortable expressing. Maybe they have it, but they just don't have a language with which to express it. It felt to me that the memoir was an opportunity almost to sort of go back and open up. Is that how you felt? Or
in a certain sense, I mean, being gay for me was the core shame of my life. And if you're a gay person in the 1950s, which is when I was first aware that I was gay, and, you know, and nobody, I mean, it was like you go to jail for being gay in many places. And I didn't know how to come out to anybody. I did come out to my parents, who were, I was pretty young. I was 13 or 14, but they were accepting, but I never found a way to come out to the people in my life. I just didn't know what to do. I thought I would just be exercised from the community. And all that mattered to me was family and friends. And having to be kicked out for my inner longings seemed like just terrible. It wasn't until college, honestly, that my best friend, I had two best friends who all we ever talked about were girls. And then it turned out we were all three gay. And but we all totally hidden. And my one friend came to see me in college and he said, I have to tell you something. He said, I'm queer, which was the word we used in the day. And I looked at him like he had saved my life, because for the first time, I could say I am too. And then that began a dialogue that allowed me to have someone in the world to talk to, which was really essential. And but I stayed relatively hidden through almost everyone I know, except for my wife, up until about 4 or 5 years ago, when I just suddenly said to myself, I don't want to leave this world hidden on any level. And I knew it would be a shock. And I teach a meditation class, and I have for over half a century. So it's a lot of people who know me and did not know this central fact. And so one class, I just said, I'm gay. And it was like incredible lifting of veils, I guess. But at that point, it didn't even matter, because I'm not living a gay life, and I had a married life. And I will tell you that the day I met my wife, the very first moment I went home with her, which was the very first day I met her, I sat her down for a long period and I just talked. And the first thing I told her says, look, I'm gay. But and there's a huge story behind all this. You know, I mean, too much probably to go into here and worth reading the book about. But I was kind of directed by something deep inside me to find the person I loved. And I kind of committed to whatever you want to call it, the universe, God, higher consciousness. I give millions of names for all of this. But I just said, bring me someone to love. And I didn't say who, and I didn't say what sex. But I said, you bring me someone and I will go forward. And almost within a day or two of that announcement, my friend said, do you want to meet a girl? And I said, yes. She walked in the door. I walked her home after we had dinner. And I basically said, look, I'm here to find someone to love. And I'm gay, but you're the person who arrived. And all I can tell you is, you know, if you are open to this, I'm open to committing to you for the rest of my life, which is totally bizarre on every possible level. And she said to me the years later, she thought I was totally crazy. But she also said, yes. And we've been together now for 55 years. So it's a kind of amazing story.
And that came after a stage in your spiritual journey to tie the two things together, as you've already done, where you, I mean, not just spiritual, but really geographical story, a kind of pilgrimage where you go and you travel to India and you travel to all the way around the world, practically, in search of a way, of a teacher. And then you come back and you kind of find it in New York City.
Yes, blocks away from where I had begun my year and a half long hitchhiking around the world looking for teachers and not finding one.
That T.S. Eliot had a point, didn't he?
yes. It's very T.S. Eliot. I should probably say for anyone who's listening to this talk that the inciting moment, which is what they would call it in a Hollywood movie, was, and I'll do it briefly, but just that my roommate at the time was also visiting regularly with Timothy Leary in Millbrook, New York, and doing LSD on a regular basis. And he had given me a tablet that I could take whenever the moment was right. And I didn't find that tablet. It just sat in my wallet. But then finally, one day I went, okay, I think today's the day. But interestingly enough, my friend was going to see Timothy the next day. And the man who supplied Timothy Leary with LSD from Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland happened to be on his way there as well with a bottle of pure lysergic acid. And he asked my roommate if he could leave it in our refrigerator overnight so he didn't have to walk around New York City carrying this bottle. And Barry said, sure. And anyway, long story short, I took the tablet that had been in my wallet and it didn't work. Next thing is, my friend said, well, I have a bottle of pure lysergic acid from Switzerland in the refrigerator. Why don't I get an eyedropper and I'll give you a drop? And I went, okay. I had nothing to lose at that point. So he fills the eyedropper and he goes to give me a drop and he goes, oops. And the whole eyedropper, which is thousands and thousands of micrograms of LSD, goes shooting down my throat. And as I say now, that after about 3 or 4 billion years, I lost count. I went through an amazing journey that was, was horrifying, liberating, shocking, disassembling, dismantling. I mean, you can go through a million words, but it completely took me apart on every level. And I had to watch myself being dismantled. And I got the sense as I was starting the journey, I was walking down this long flight of stairs and, I looked and noticed there were these two people beside me, but they were not like people, they're like demons. And I said, where am I going? And they said, you know where you're going. And I looked down in front of me and a sign with like almost in neon lights went hell. And it really was a kind of a journey into hell. And every part of me was taken apart and every false statement, every lie I'd ever done, everything that was not living up to my best self was exposed in a way that was way beyond my, I may have thought it was like a baddish thing, but this was like worse. And there was also something wildly familiar about what was happening. In fact, my first words as the LSD kicked in were, oh, this again. And not like I had been here many, many times. So the journey in the end, the very end of it, I was left in a pool of being that was like an oceanic space with nothing, nothing. There was no Bruce. There was no anything at all. It was just complete emptiness, not bad, kind of like a cozy night's sleep emptiness. But then something impregnated me, like plopped into me. I don't know what. And I divided into this half and then quarters. And I just kept dividing. And then my hand and elbow came back and then my head and then the wall. And I was back in the room that where all this started, like eons later. And I started laughing and going, why? Am I back? And this voice, which became the directive of my whole life, when I asked, why am I back? It said, to tell people what you saw. Then I thought, well, what did I see? I had no words for it. Nothing in human experience prepared me for the vastness, the ancientness, the magnitude of what had happened on LSD. And so I had to figure it out. And all I can tell you is I was led to books like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which describes what's called Bardo experience after you die and you start to have to go through the kind of journey I had just gone through. I started looking at Hindu teachings, the Bhagavad Gita. I started looking at Judeo-Christian mystical teachings. And I realized these things have been talked about for centuries, but they're not at the core of religious teaching. They're sort of in the background, but they are really important. And I came away from the experience thinking, I better find out more about this. And so I took a job for a year working at NBC News with Huntley Brinkley and tried to get on every newscast I could to talk about LSD and why it would change the world. But some young guy in Brooklyn killed his grandmother and blamed it on LSD and suddenly, you know, was banned everywhere. So I couldn't even talk about it. So I quit my job at NBC News and I began hitchhiking around the world looking for a teacher. And I spent a year and a half meeting amazing people, but nobody who had what I wanted. And when I came back to America, four blocks from where I lived, I went to take these Tibetan carpets for these monks I had lived with in Kathmandu into the shop of an antique dealer who'd dealt with Asian art. And he asked what I was doing in Asia. And I said, looking for a teacher. He said, did you find one? I said, no. He said, well, you know, I can teach you everything you want to know. And it was like total hubris on one level. And yet something in me knew it was true. I don't know how or why. And I went to a class that he taught. It was so strange beyond belief, but he had a group of students and he sat on a platform and he suddenly looked at everybody in the room. And as he looked at me, I fell off my chair, literally like exploded off my chair. And I went, whoa, wow. And I had never had that before. And he called it an energy exchange, which it was. And he said, this will open you up to your inner being, to your inner life, and then described to me something that we Westerners know nothing about, which is we don't just exist in the outer, we exist in this inner space. And other than anxiety and some love and some worry and stuff that goes on inside us, we don't have a real map of the inner world, whereas we have a somewhat of a map of the outer. But the one thing we do know, and Buddhism really hits this, is it's all impermanent. But it's also, when you're only in the outer world, you're wildly unbalanced, you know, because there's a whole inner dynamic that if you don't access, what happens is that you find yourself out of kilter. You don't know how to move forward. You don't have a GPS, you know, at all. And you're just blindly moving through the world. And the great thing about LSD, and then what I discovered studying with my teacher, whose name was Rudy, an amazing guy, he showed me the map, the inner map to myself, to my deepest self. And then I discovered the deepest self was a shared self that we all have together, which is hard to grasp in a way, but we all share this deeper self. And it is very instructive and constructive and directive. And it does say, turn right, turn left. But it also does this thing where if you've ever been in a car with a GPS and you know, okay, for the next 40 miles, just keep going, you don't hear a voice saying anything. It's just like, oh my God, is it working? Is the GPS working? It doesn't keep going. You're doing great. You're doing fine. It doesn't do anything until it says in 2 miles, turn right. This inner thing does exactly the same thing. It says in 2 miles, you're going to have to make a choice. But if it doesn't tell you to do something, it doesn't matter if you turn right or left because it's fine. But when it tells you, I have learned, listen, pay attention. Boy, does it give you an amazing ride, an amazing life. And for me, a little kid from Detroit, having a Hollywood life, having a wife and children and grandchildren and, you know, teaching and people who I love, you know, around me all the time. It all came from, I can't even describe what it came from, but mostly from paying attention to the GPS. But you got to find the GPS. You got to find it.
The awakening that you had and these teachings that you had from Rudy, and I imagine I sometimes do some teaching, and so, you know, one thing, it's a truism, but it's very true that you learn more teaching people than you learn as a student.
Yeah, you're the first person to hear the words, you know.
How did this inform you in terms of you going back to your sort of love of movies and wanting to tell stories? Because in a sense, you've already mentioned it, the root of that storytelling is not disconnected from this spiritual yearning, and it is connected to wishing on a star and hoping there'll be a circus there tomorrow.
Well, and also being told, tell people what you saw. And all I wanted to do was to try to describe that there is this amazing, magical, mystical inner universe that we're not taught about mostly in our culture. We're told get a job and make love and have kids and, you know, and whatever. But nobody talks about this infinite realm that's in us that is probably the most important piece of missing information in our lives. And so I wanted to talk about it, but I didn't quite know how. And then I began trying to find stories that would work in my brain. And they, interestingly, started to be delivered. You know, I found, for whatever it's worth, that the universe supports those who are committed to hearing and listening and following directives. And the universe made me go through some hoops, you know, that I went through, and it went, okay, check, you're good. You're good. We're going to deliver this now. And so they delivered me these different story ideas, which started to become the core of movies. Now, I loved movies since I was a little kid, and I always wanted to make movies. And my grandmother's first cousin married one of the Warner Brothers. So I always imagined I was part of the Warner Brother troupe, and that Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny were my cousins, kind of. You know, that's how I looked at it. But, you know, it's not that easy to get into Hollywood. And I started writing a number of movies, and it's a long, painful story because Hollywood is not an easy place to enter. I always tell people there's no open door. You go through the crack at the bottom, and you've got to get pretty low down to fall through that crack. But I started writing these films that had a kind of core spiritual alternate reality aspect. And the very first one I think that I wrote was called, at the time, the George Dunlap tape. It became a film called Brainstorm. And Doug Trumbull, who was a special effects guy for 2001, A Space Odyssey and Close Encounters and films like that, he fell in love with the script and decided to direct it. Lots of elements that happened that pulled it away from my control, but the film did get made, and it took a long time and had a lot of difficult and some tragic aspect, including Natalie Wood, who was the star, dying before we finished the film. But that began a journey for me of writing. And I just started to find that I had a kind of a voice for it. And some of the, like I say, the early scripts that I did that didn't get made are now in this book called Three Visionary Screenplays. And I think if one were to read them today, you would see this could be a really good movie. I'm not sure Hollywood yet would even make them, but they're really interesting stories that are getting my feet wet. And then the bigger stories started to come. And Jacob's Ladder was maybe one of the big ones I wrote. And it, you know, it took forever to get it seen or made at all. But Jacob, I wrote it starting with a dream that I had, that I was getting off a subway train and couldn't, the exit was blocked. And I didn't know what to do. And I just realized I had to go across the tracks to get out on the other side, and started to cross the tracks, which are very dangerous third rail experiences. And then a train came bearing down on me with this light. And it was like the white light of reality, which is what Tibetans talk about as the thing that you go into when you die. And I didn't want to die. So I tried to get to the other side. But all I know is I woke up from that dream saying, oh, good idea for a movie. This is how I'm going to start a movie. But then I didn't know where the movie went or what to do with it. But gradually I discovered it was really my LSD trip on film. And it was about the process, giving it away here on some level, but it's about the process of dying, you know, what one goes through in order to let go of the world. And it's not fun. It's not pretty. Because if you haven't learned to let go of everything, and that's something you're going to have to do, then it's going to be ripped away. And if you have learned or practiced, which is the idea of the meditative life or spiritual life, then the dying process is beautiful. It's a movement into light. But trying to convince people that they should be letting go now, spending their life, is really hard. And now that I'm 81 years old, what I've discovered is, boy, oh boy, am I glad I practiced this, because it comes into real play when you get toward the end. Because now you're really letting go. It's taking stuff away. And either you go, thank you for being there, goodbye, or you go, no, not me. But what does that mean? What, me? There's no one who's spared this, nobody, including whoever is listening to this. You are going to have to let go of everything. And if you don't know how to let go, it's not going to be fun. That's all I can say, unless you're blessed in some way. And some people are, that they, you know, my mother-in-law lost her memory gradually over the course of her last years and forgot everyone she hated and everyone who did her wrong and all the things that had been bad in life. And she became a very gentle, quiet soul. And it was all taken away in a way that she was finally able to let go. And her passing was beautiful, just beautiful. So I realized there are different versions of how you go about this kind of journey. But Jacob's Ladder was a really important sort of depiction of something I thought needed to be put in the world. And I was really grateful that I did. And at, right around the same time, I had this idea for a movie about a ghost who is still around and has no idea what it means to be a ghost, and realizes he was killed, and that person who killed him may have sights on the woman he loved, and he needs to save her. And that's all I had, but I just thought that's a good idea for a movie. And I started writing a treatment for that movie. So because I had now moved to Hollywood, and I had to sell ideas to studios, let them give me money so I could pay for my house rental and my family and schools and all that stuff. And so I had to pitch this, and I had to learn how you pitch a movie. And, you know, it's not easy to sit in front of people who hold your life in their hands and they give you 3 minutes to sell a story that makes them feel.
You have some practical tips as well. Like, I always say yes to the T.
Yes, exactly. You have a good memory. Yes. I mean, the first one is slow down, quiet down, get centered is what I call it. And if you don't know what centering is, then that'll be a bit of a problem. But centering is just being still inside and get everybody still with you. Because most of the people in a studio setting they've heard 1,000 stories a day. And most of them go, nope, not yet, nope, not really, no, not interested. And I got a lot of those. So you have to learn how to tell a story. And then I finally realized if I could turn them all into like kindergarten children and be the teacher and tell the story in a way a teacher would. And what really worked for me, strangely, was in telling the story of Ghost. The minute that Sam is shot and killed, I went, slammed my hands together like that, and I created a big loud noise, and everybody in the room jumped, and all these studio executives. And I knew at their jump that I had them, because they had become little kids and they were in the story. And the death moment was really important, and it got their attention, and what you want is attention. And I did this for like a year, and for a long time, I kept learning how to do it and learning. By the end of that year or so, I was at a point where I went into 5 different studio offices in a week, and everyone wanted all 5.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
People, I had finally really come to learn how to do it, and it sold, you know, and I got to pick the studio that I wanted, which was Paramount, and we got to make the movie there. And of course, you know, that movie changed my life, because it was not imagined by anybody to be anything more than another little Hollywood something that would come and go. And you know, and we had a hard time getting it off the ground, getting a lead actor, getting Patrick Swayze was a challenge. Whoopi, not she was, I mean, they weren't challenges exactly. It's just that the director didn't want Patrick and I didn't want Whoopi, but we were both totally wrong. I mean, completely, absolutely wrong. And you know, Jerry Zucker, the director, had said, even though we couldn't find an actor who was going to go forward, we talked about Patrick, and he said, over my dead body. Mm. And then the day Patrick came in and read for the part, which is something I secretly arranged to have happen in the background, which I shouldn't admit to, but I did. And he read, and he did all the right things. He came in, as I told him, wear a suit, carry a suitcase, I'm in a briefcase, and look like a banker. He read, and then when he left the room, Jerry said, well, from now on, whenever I say over my dead body, that's who we hire. And it's sort of, for me, the same thing with Whoopi. You know, I mean, she was so amazing, so remarkable, so deserving of the Oscar that she got. And the minute I heard her, I just went, you know, Bruce, you were projecting the wrong image. You know, mm-hmm. she's extraordinary. So that film was about to open, and they were having previews all over the country, about 10,000 of them. And I was in Detroit trying to promote the movie. There was another movie coming out called Ghost Dad the same week or week before. And when people heard that I was with the movie Ghost, they said, oh, like, too bad. You know, you don't have the Bill Cosby movie Ghost Dad. But we were in a theater for previews, and they were showing the Tom Cruise Days of Thunder movie. And it was so crowded. And Blanche, my wife, and I sat in the second row because there were no other seats available during that. And then we were going to wait and see the preview of Ghost for people. And the theater emptied out, completely emptied. And we were like, oh, this is, no one's going to come to see this movie. It was the most devastating thing. And so we were in the second row, just sitting, staring at a blank screen. And suddenly two people sat in front of us. And I was trying to figure out, why would anybody sit in row 2 or 1 of the theater? And I turned around and I looked, the theater was full, just full. And then an announcement came over the loudspeaker saying, nobody can sit in the aisles. The fire department will not allow anyone in the aisle. And I went, I had no idea. And that was the first indication I had that I had what you might call a hit film. And then it opened to modest reviews, unfortunately, but a massive audience. And it was the number one film of the year, starting in July, opened on July, Friday the 13th, July, and was still playing Christmas. And that doesn't happen very often. Big, big films came and go, and Ghost was still like number one film. And And I had never had that experience before. I've never had it really since, although I've had some, some nice films. But that was like life-changing. It was on every level, financially and emotionally and creatively. And it kept me working because Hollywood, there's no guarantee that you're going to work from film to film. And so I was grateful I had a career. And it was another one of those films that kind of gets into tell people what you saw. That most of the theme of that is that we exist probably before we're born and we continue to exist after. I wanted to just kind of, that's all I wanted to say, is that there's a larger scope to our existence than we tend to believe. And yes, it's a ghost story. And yes, it could be just seen as a little fairy tale, but it's not how I looked at it. And a lot of people kind of got that message.
Looking at your career, there are of those movies we've just talked about, they're all original stories. They're all, and that is something that I don't want to, I don't want to be an old grumpy and say, these days, et cetera, especially, I think we've had a very good year for cinema 2023, 2024 so far. It's been wonderful. But it is great to have those original stories because you feel like you're really adding something to the culture rather than adding an interpretation.
Excuse me. Yes, it's great. The only problem is, and I'll just tell you the Hollywood version of this, you price yourself out of writing original stories because suddenly you have to support a family. You know, you have to pay now for the house you bought or built, rather than the house you were renting. But what I did, and I think this was fair, was I wrote the original stories that I could, and then I started being asked to write other movies. But in every movie I was asked to write, I saw a possible opening for saying something that was important. And nothing was brought to me that felt that it was just for the money. I mean, not nothing, because there were a few that I couldn't turn down. But I will say most of the films I wrote were to try to implant certain kinds of awareness or seeds in people that would make them connect to a larger version or vision in the world. So, I mean, they're like Sleeping with the Enemy. That was not a film that I felt added to the equation, but it really did, it helped support my life. But Deep Impact and Time Traveler's Wife, and even a film called The Last Mimsy, all had these spiritual underpinnings that were, I thought, important to put out into the universe. And they allowed me to do that. And so I felt good about that. Even something like Stuart Little 2, which I think many people would imagine would had no value on some level, I had a real concept for that film that had a lot to do with the idea of flying and floating, the idea of being supported by the air itself, by life itself. It didn't quite make it into the final film, but it certainly was in the script that I wrote. And so I took on projects like that because I just felt that they added something to the culture, even if they weren't my original ideas. So a career in the end is a strange thing to sustain in Hollywood. And I learned a lot about what it's like. I mean, it's from a spiritual perspective, it's what I call the diminishment of the ego self, because everything's taken away from you. The directors do not want you on the set usually when they're making a film, because you have too many words to say while they're shooting and you get in the way. It was not true with Jerry Zucker on Ghost, who was wonderful and inclusive, and Adrian Lyne mostly was very happy to have me around, although I had less time there. Almost every other film I've ever done, I maybe got to the set once, if at all, to see it. So you don't have a role in it. And the writer in Hollywood, and I use this description pretty often, if you have a totem pole of where the writer sits in Hollywood, it's not even the low one on the totem pole. It's the part that you stick in the ground. That's who the writer is in Hollywood. And that, if you have an ego that can ride that out, or if you have an ego that can be dismantled enough from a spiritual perspective, this sense of separate celebrated self, as it goes away, begins to reveal a kind of larger self that can only be known and experienced when you finally let go of being separate from everything. There's a kind of being broken down into something that is not a loss. It's a gain if you don't try to own it. All you can know is you're part of something amazingly vast and infinite. And being a person in the world in a body is an amazing, wonderful experience. but it's very short-lived. It's tiny, and it's got little purpose in it that you may or may not understand. But when it's over, from my sort of spiritual journey and experience, what's left is infinite and beyond understanding. It's like the drop of an ocean discovering it's the ocean, you know, or a wave. You know, it's like a drop is a drop, but when it returns to its source, poof, you discover what and who you are. And my spiritual journey over the course of all these years has been just discovery upon discovery and discovery. And I will say, just for whatever it's worth, it went through a period of knowing everything where I had all the answers. You asked me a question, I could tell you all the multitudes of dimensions and all the things that people try to analyze. All of that's gone away from me. Every bit of it, every bit of certainty that I've ever had in my life has gone away. And I've come to a point of absolutely knowing nothing. And the only kind of teaching that I've come to in, you know, 60 years of meditative life is be a good person, be kind. That's kind of the only thing I have arrived at. And everything else has fallen away. And I try to describe that the falling away of knowing is a kind of letting weight fall away. And it becomes, you become lighter and lighter, and then perhaps enlightened by the loss of knowing, by the loss of all these truisms. And then all you have is what's in front of you. And all I can tell you is be kind to that, whatever it may be, the people, the situation, the moment, the thought, the thing you have to do in the world, be kind. And it really is an amazing teaching. And it's not my teaching. It's, you know, the Dalai Lama will tell you the same thing Jesus would tell you. I mean, it goes on and on, you know, who will teach you all of that. So, but it's very simple. And any human being can get that, anybody. So when I understood that, that was where my teaching had gone to. It was when I realized I could finish the book. I could finish my book because I didn't have to talk about awakening and enlightenment and nirvana and all these other things that I somehow felt needed to be attained and owned and have and had to be possessed. By not possessing anything and not having anything at all, the truth of the underlying simplicity of it all came through. And I said, okay, there's the end of a book. And that's kind of what happened. And that's when I finally said to Joe and to Paul, my editors, I said, we got a book. And they agreed. And so that's why you and I are talking, because that book got written. And you know, no one has to buy it now, because all they're going to find out is, you know, what Patrick Swayze was like, and be kind.
Patrick Swayze, he was nice, I imagine.
Yeah, he was. He was. He wasn't the brightest light bulb in the world. And I don't mean to say that disparagingly. He would kind of laugh at it and admit it. He told me a story, and I think it's been published since this. But when he told it to me, it was kind of a depiction of Patrick, which was he always thought he looked dumb. And the only way for him to try to look less dumb, he thought, was to wear glasses. But he didn't think of getting glasses that had no lenses or a clear lens. He went to the drugstore and bought glasses that were reading glasses, and he put them on, and he said he was dizzy for years, but he would walk around with a kind of misperception of the world, but he looked smart. But it was like the dumbest choice ever. And I think, in a way, that discrepancy is kind of at the core of Patrick. He was lovely, lovely person. I mean, I loved being with him. And, you know, and every person that I got to meet in Hollywood, in almost every case, was extraordinary and exciting to be with. And movie stars are really interesting people. And I get to write about some of them, mostly in very positive terms, and some not. But I did find that, you know, the Hollywood journey is part of a spiritual journey for me. It's not just a Hollywood journey. So, yes, I will talk about, you know, the people I loved and the ones I didn't love, but I also talk about the larger context in which all of that occurred and how I was mostly just following the GPS, which happened to go through Hollywood.
I'm sure there'll be quite a few people listening to this who themselves maybe have ambitions to be screenwriters, maybe want to break into the industry. Rather than even a how-do question, it's almost like, I was wondering from a spiritual angle, was it more difficult the struggle to get there, or was it more difficult the success that happened when you did?
I would say getting there was the hardest part. Mm-hmm. People write to me all the time and say, how do I do it? Mm-hmm. You know, and there's no simple answer. I mean, the simplest answer I have is, if you want to be a screenwriter, write a movie, or rewrite your movie. And then probably submit them to the contests that are out there, including the Writers Guild and the Academy. They all have contests, and all of the people, agents who buy screenplays or try to promote screenplay, put it that way, they're looking for access too. So if something wins an award, they're going to be intrigued by that. So if you can get your script seen, that helps a lot. Getting it through the door is tricky. Getting someone to put up the money for it. The nature of the business, of course, is changing dramatically. So if you're writing a Marvel comic book, that's fine. But if you're not Marvel, that's not as fine. You know, you have, how do you sell that idea? Nowadays, we have, streaming, what do you want to call it? Television movies, but they're much more like novels. You know, they go on and on and on and on. And so it's like, a movie is 120 pages at most, usually. A streaming book would be literally, a streaming script would be many, many more than that. And it's a different kind of writing. It's just a different kind of storytelling. It really is much more novelistic, but cinematic. And so how do you break into an industry that's going through so much change and will continue to go through change? And they're all figuring it out. Nobody has answers. So you may have to become the answer, but a good story is a good story. And clearly, you can self-publish. It means you may not make money, but you can get stories at least, you know, out there. But if you want to get into Hollywood and you want to go through those doors, it is not an easy path. It's just not. And Brian De Palma told me when my first film opened, Brainstorm, and we were having lunch with him, he said, if you want a career in Hollywood, you got to move here. And my wife was with me, and we went back to Illinois where we were living, and she quit her job. And she said, we're putting our house up for sale and we're moving to Hollywood, which was like the most courageous thing ever in my experience. And I was terrified, but it turned out to be the right move. Whether I would recommend that to people today, maybe if you start dovetailing with the right people and somebody, an actor reads your script and gets it to the right person and gets it to the right person. Yes, you may in fact find a pathway. You know, you never know. My door kind of opened because somebody was doing an article for a magazine called American Film on the 10 best unproduced screenplays in Hollywood. And a friend of mine, and I call her an angel in my life, who's later a vice president at Paramount, recommended Jacob's Ladder. This guy read Jacob's Ladder, and it became one of the 10 best unproduced screenplays in this article. And I would say 6 or 7 of them became major hit movies. And Jacob's Ladder became a movie, if not a hit. But you know, we had a screening of it the other day at a theater here in upstate New York, and the theater was almost full. And I was going, 35 years later, how does that happen? But it still speaks to people. And that's important. If I had screenings of other of my films, I don't know, we'd have me in the theater and my wife, you know. So
it's one of my favorites from the time I saw it at the cinema when it came out. And there are moments in that film that stayed with me. The penny being pushed away by the blast of the explosion and the subway. Right. And I loved in the book that you referenced it, because as soon as you said it, I thought, yes, of course, Ambrose Bierce, the occurrence at Owl Creek, being an inspiration for you. Spoilers for anybody who haven't read Ambrose Bierce or haven't seen Jacob's Ladder. But yeah, that's real. I think that's got a real cult classic status.
Well, it does. And I think if you know Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, you do know what Jacob's Ladder is. On the other hand, I get emails and I see things written about it with people saying, what was that movie about? What was that? I mean, it's not like it's not there. It's very, very visible and it's very in your face, but it's so powerfully disturbing to the psyche. And there's a part of us that doesn't want to know what Jacob's Ladder is showing us. And I've seen person after person, it's like, it's too disturbing, you know? And yet, as I watched it the other day, it was one of the first times in years, I just felt, this is not a movie, it's an experience. It is so powerful, intense, and disturbing. And Adrian Lyne is such an amazingly good director. It has such subtlety, such tiny little moments that reflect in a way that make you go, you're not just in a movie, you're in a truly, truly other world experience that's going to transform you if you let it. So I'm grateful that Jacob's Ladder got made. And I'm grateful it got made by Adrian. And I think it's a kind of an extraordinary experience to go through and will linger. It will stay in the culture because we need films that challenge us in that way and wake us up. But you need fortitude to do it. I mean, I saw people in the theater who said they said to me, I've tried watching this movie before and many times and I can't get past a certain part. It's just too hard for me, too scary. And they wanted to endure it and they went through it and they were so grateful that they got to the end and saw what it really was and where it lifted them to and what they knew as the film closed and let what it offers human beings is an insight into the hope of the journey we're all on. So that's felt good to me. And again, 34 years later since the film came out. And I go, you know, here we are, we're talking about this movie. And that's very touching to me. You know, I've made other films that people haven't talked about, but, you know, I get feedback from people every so often. For example, I don't know how much time we have here, but I will.
But by all means, I was going to ask you this question, which is, you know, what films, other than the ones that we've already covered, do you feel that are most, that you wish people would perhaps go back and revisit?
Well, the one I'm mentioning, because it was a great teacher for me, one of the great teachers. It was this film called My Life with Michael Caine and Nicole Kidman. And basically the story of a man who discovers he's going to die and his wife is pregnant and he will not live long enough to meet his, and he wants to leave something for the child so he knows who his father was. And he decides to make a video of his life, about his life, and then discovers he has no idea who he was. He has no clue. He is a man without any introspection at all. But the movie is his making that video and what occurs, and is pretty potent emotionally, I think. But it didn't do well at the box office and had some very bad reviews. And talk about ego crushing, when that film was done, I went into a spiraling depression for about 6 months or something like that. It was just crushing on every level. I thought it was a good film. I still think it's a really, really good film. But what happened, and this was really important, and I tell this story a lot because it's a great, important lesson. I was at a party, and this woman comes up to me and says, I understand you wrote the movie My Life. I said, yes. She said, I need to tell you a story. She said, my husband died 3 years ago, and my son, who was 10, was totally unable ever to talk about it. He's never been able to respond to the death of his. He said, and then tragically, I just found out that I have terminal cancer. And all I could think of is, I need to talk to my son, and how am I going to do that? And we went to see this movie called My Life, and my son started sobbing during the movie. And we walked home, and he crawled into my lap. He's now 13 years old. And we sat there, and we had the discussion that would make it possible for me to leave this world. So thank you. And I had this enormous feeling of gratitude for having made the film, and then the realization that I had made it for them. That was it. It didn't matter. It didn't matter if there were tens and thousands or millions of people who saw it. These two people saw it, and it had this kind of profound impact on these two people. And I got it. I got it. I got why we tell stories. It's not about numbers. It's about depth. It's about touching. It's about feeling. It's about transmitting a lesson or an idea or something that will be transformative for one or two people.
And what serendipity in your life that you should meet those people and be able to get that.
You should know that mostly the universe prevented me from meeting anybody who saw any of my films, including Ghosts, which, you know, was the most popular film of that year. And I could never meet people who saw it. They just kept me out of that loop. I don't know what it was. I heard one woman in a restaurant saying to her friend, did you see that horrible movie Ghost? You know, and I just turned and walked away. And a taxi cab driver who asked what I did, and I said I was a screenwriter, I wrote this movie Ghost, and there were billboards all over New York City. He said, oh, I think I heard of it. Those are the kinds of feedbacks that I would get. And I finally looked at that universe protecting me from, you know, whatever you want to call it, the pride of ownership. Because I was the transcriber of those films more than the writer. You know, I was the thing that allowed it to flow through. But I got to see it before anybody else in my brain. But I don't take ownership, really. I think most writers are given a gift. And those who get the fact that it's a gift thrive in that gift. Those who think it's them, turn to drink, you know?
Perhaps that answered my question that I gave, I asked earlier as well of, you know, what was more difficult, the struggle or the success? Because it sounds like the universe was looking out for you with the success.
Yes, I think so. And I, you know, I mean, they've given me very comfortable spaces to live in.
Mm-hmm.
So I've lived in nice homes. They've given me a wonderful family. I'm wildly proud of my family and my grandchildren and an extraordinary wife who took this incredible gamble of, you know, taking hold of a gay guy and saying, okay, I will do this. And, you know, luckily, I was able to have sex in every direction. And it was very, that was not a problem for us, but she really, she gambled. And I think she feels she won. I know I did. And it's all, you know, it's coming to an end. We're in our, you know, in the 80s. But to look back on your life and go, yeah, and losing my ego identity is not a punishment on any level. I just feel like, thank you, take it all. You know, what's left is just open-eyed looking around, looking at life and going, wow, thank you.
Can I ask, in terms of your sexuality, in terms of being gay, how did that inform your writing? Were there moments where you were, you know, did it give you perspective? Did you put things in films which you thought, well, this is that strand of my life?
I tried to a little bit.
Because I did see Ghost, and I was watching Ghost the other night, and I was sort of thinking, oh, the guys are really in love, aren't they? You know,
Well, it's an interesting point, and you know, I actually was very attracted to those guys as actors and cast people, but the gay thing, in the film Jacob's Ladder, we lost 1/5 of the movie in the last month before it was released, and a lot of reasons for that. One of them is that they did test audience screenings and found out that with that last 20 minutes of the film, half the audience loved the movie and half didn't. When they cut it out, half loved it and half didn't. So they thought, why don't we just cut it out and make this shorter film? And I was devastated by that idea. But the character who at that point tells Jacob about the truth of what the experiments that supposedly happened in Vietnam is gay. Mm-hmm. And there's a real acknowledgement of his gayness. And it's one of the few really gay characters I ever wrote, but then not with anything of my doing. He got cut out of the film. But exploring gay sexuality, you know, it doesn't add to a story particularly. I mean, to me, sexuality is an amazing thing. Two people touching, just touching. It's the most amazing thing in the world. And I have never experienced anything more powerful in life than as a teacher. I've learned to touch with my eyes, which most of us in a way do. Those of us who are attracted to somebody explore them with our eyes. And there's a kind of touch in that. In spiritual teaching, there's something called mudra, which is hand movement. And it sends energy forces into the world. You can actually do healing with it. You can touch people with it without any physical contact. So I've learned a lot about touch and the joy of touching another without physically touching them. The joy of loving beauty and sexual beauty in front of you is a kind of a phenomenal joy. Having an orgasm is great, but when you're in your 80s, it's not quite the same thing as when you're in your 30s, 40s, if you hope 50s, maybe 60s, you know? And I love the idea of sex. I love the idea of people exploring their sexuality in some true and honest way. I think society is so messed up in that universe, and I was born into the worst of it in the 50s. You know, the idea that that you can go to jail for touching another human being. You know, like whoa, what is that? And certainly being dismissed by your families and friends. And you know, the thing I cared most about was love and contact. So I didn't know really how to get it into the films. It was kind of central to my life, but it wasn't central to my storytelling. Mm-hmm. And as you can tell from this, what I'm telling you now, it never became public knowledge in a real way until just recently. Mm-hmm. So, but it, not that it was so much hidden, I guess, because there were people who needed to know who did know. My children knew, my best friends knew, my parents knew, some of my relatives knew. But there are some of my relatives who are going to be buying this book or getting this book in the next months, who are the first line of the book is I'm gay and I don't know what they're going to do with it. So I am a little bit afraid of how this is all going to play out in the world. I have no idea. And, you know, there's also a certain little bit of sadomasochism in the book.
I was going to say,
well,
maybe a little bit delighted as well.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But God knows it's better to be open and honest than not. Yeah. It's better not to carry secrets. And I don't want to carry secrets to the grave at all. Yeah. And I find myself now so much at peace with just being who I am on every level. And if people dismiss me, who cares? I just don't care at all. You know, I'm not here to, the people who I need to have love me do love me. I need to love myself, which has been a life's journey, you know, to love the being that I am and that we are, basically. I have learned that lesson through years of inner life, inner practice of going inside myself and sitting in that rocking chair in my heart and going, lighting the fire and going, this is lovely. You know, I like being here.
And you're still teaching today.
I teach a meditation class to this day. And unfortunately or fortunately, podcasts like this have started having people reach out to me who want to come to the class. And, you know, I'm not teaching in auditoriums. I teach in my home. And I also teach on Zoom because of the pandemic. But, you know, it's only so many people I can handle. So I don't know how to handle that idea, but I am being responsive. I had 20 new students yesterday, and I went, oh my God, this is complicated. But you know, to the degree that I can do that, I will. I do talks. They're all on YouTube. You know, I have about 500 talks on YouTube that talk about all this stuff. But the actual class, which is an experiential energy exchange between teacher student, that's pretty, it's pretty extraordinary thing. And if I hadn't met Rudy, I would never have understood its possibility. And what I have come to in the end is you can exchange energy with people in many ways. Probably the most powerful is through the meditative experience that I practice. But there's also something I call presence. If you are present, truly present with another human being, it's a spiritual experience, even if they're not present. Mm. You know, I sit with people who are not present and I just am present. And I will tell you, at the end of whatever meal we're having or dialogue we're having, that presence has worked its way into whoever I am with, singular or plural. And there is a softening and an opening and a joy and a kind of love that starts to permeate the space. And it comes from not doing anything, but being present with who's there. And, you know, my teacher Rudy used to say, if it's in front of you, it's yours. Mm-hmm. And I came up with this a little addition to that, which is if it's in front of you, it's sacred, period. And that means washing the dishes, cleaning the toilet, you know, making the bed, all of that stuff. It's yours. And either you're there for it or you're not. And if you're not, you are not present. And if you're not present, you are missing out of what it means to be alive, really. And when you do it, I will tell you, the universe doesn't go good boy, but it does go click. Yep, yep, yep.
Yeah.
There's a kind of, if someone is doing it, someone is living up to the gift of being here by doing it right.
That's wonderful. I don't want to really add anything else, but I do have to ask one final question, which is the sort of question I ask all my guests, which is a book recommendation for specifically film books. If you have any film book recommendations, you'd like to give our listeners.
I don't. And forgive me for that. I don't read a lot at this point. Being a writer, I spent my whole life writing. About movies now is not, it's not a subject I even care about that much, you know? So I don't know what to recommend, but I know there are good books out there, and I know that if you just, follow your inner directive, you will know the one that sparks and speaks to you and get it and read it and see where it takes you. But my feeling for people who love movies, who want to make movies, is you've got to find your stories. What are the stories you want to tell? And that's everything. What do you have to tell the world that maybe hasn't been seen from any other perspective other than yours? Finding your story is the key. And some books will help you maybe discover what that is, but mostly you've got a journey in the world in some way. I mean, for me, my career didn't start till my 40s. And part of that was I didn't have anything to say that I understood until I was in my 40s. So find out what you have to say, find out what your story is, and then write the book on movies rather than read it.
I know there are two brilliant books on movies by Bruce Rubin that I would heartily recommend. One, a memoir, and the other, three visionary screenplays. Thank you.
Thank you for doing this. And, you know, if people want to read, it's only a movie. They will, I think, find themselves entertained And there's some real experiences of the human journey that come through it. So thank you for allowing me this moment. I appreciate it very much, John.
It's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.